committee will come to order, please. I noticed we had a few students cycling through, and I think we'll have some more. Oh, here they come. All right, so welcome to the students coming in. So it's my understanding, and I'll just look for a nod from the person who's directing, that students from Como and Harding High Schools here for the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans Day at the Capitol. So welcome, students. We're glad to have you here. If you can stick around for a little while. I know you're probably coming through on your way to other meetings and that, but we're glad that you're here today. So thank you so much. And Representative Moran, are these some of the students that you represent?
They are some of my constituents, yes.
Excellent. Excellent.
I'm really excited to see them here today. They have been a day long of events and activities, so welcome, you guys.
Excellent. All right, thank you. Thank you for being here. I love it when we have students who come to our committee. So we're talking about things that directly affect you, so thanks for being here. All right, so we're a little short on quorum, but I think what we're going to do is go ahead and proceed, and we'll take our public testimony on the governor's budget, which is our plans for today, and then at some point we maybe will take a brief minute to adopt the minutes from the previous meeting, but we'll take care of that housekeeping later on. But with that, we do have a pretty good list of people who had signed up, and if there's anyone who hadn't signed up would still like to testify, we should have time for that. I'm guessing, estimating from how much time we have and where we are. But with that, I'd like to start with Mr. Terry Wilding, the superintendent. Excuse me, I have a sneeze coming. Superintendent for the Minnesota State Academies. And if you want to come forward, please. All right, and we do have an interpreter for us, the committee, as well. And so, Mr. Wilding, we appreciate you being here to present your testimony. And if you would just provide the committee with your name and then offer your remarks, we welcome that.
Good afternoon, everyone. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for allowing me to come today. My name is Terry Wilding. I am the new superintendent for the Minnesota State Academies in the Faribault area. We run two academies. One is for the deaf school and one is for the blind school. We have different services available to support a variety of kids throughout the state. We are a statewide agency, so we serve students in many of your districts. We have students from north, south, east, and west, all from the borders, coming to our school. We are a residential school. Students come to us during the week, and they stay with us on the campus, and they go home to their families on the weekends. There are a variety of students, deaf, hard of hearing, blind, visually impaired. There's a wide variety of students we serve. The students that come to us have different additional needs as well. So we serve the full gamut of students. I am here today to make comments in support of the governor's proposal related to education and our allocation. We have asked for some increases based on our operating budget. And the reason for that is we are trying to develop programs and services that would give us the foundation to expand our connections to many of the public school districts throughout the state. Those public school districts are serving deaf, blind students, but they really don't have a lot of people available with licensure, and they're having a hard time finding services. We want to try and help fill that gap and support those school districts. But we need to build our program. And we're working hard right now to develop strategies and setting up those programs, putting them in place so we can share that with the different school districts throughout the state. We've started to develop those connections with some local school districts. And with that increase in the budget that the governor proposed, we would increase our assessment team, our evaluation team, and our consultation team for both the deaf and blind throughout the state. That is a quick synopsis of what we're trying to do with that operating budget increase. We're trying to support all students throughout the state, and we believe that's important. They're a very low incidence group, few deaf kids, few blind kids throughout the state. So it's hard for a district to have the appropriate expertise and knowledge and the equipment, technology that matches those students when there's only one or two in a district. That's why we would like to provide those services and give that support to the school districts for everyone. We have the expertise. Right now we have 160 students on our campus, but we're looking at serving more students in an outreach program. With that, I will allow the opportunity for you to ask me questions, and I can expand on more of the information that you were provided. I know there's a lot of things on your agenda, so I would like to keep this as short and sweet as I could. If you'd like to take the opportunity, I'm willing to answer your questions at this time.
Thank you very much, Superintendent Wilding. And again, we appreciate you being here. The committee did do a tour, and I'll call it a field trip, to the academies last year, which we very much enjoyed, and I hope that we can do that again. I think we all found
sure,
it very,
definitely.
Very beneficial. So, any questions for Superintendent Wilding? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to know what different kinds of assistive technology are used in the academies or at the academies for our children.
Mr. Wilding.
It's hard to answer that question because there's so many different devices and equipment that we do use. It depends on the individual student's IEP plan, the individual education program. So what the student needs for accessibility is given and stated that in their IEP. There could be reading software for JAWS, similar to how a blind student would be able to read that. We do provide iPads to the students for speech to text. Those that can't speak, they can speak, the iPad can speak for them. We have many of those. We have things that adaptive equipment for physical challenge students that they can access computers or iPads through different types of software and switches that we have designed. We have hearing aids, cochlear implants, visual equipment that has been adapted for our students that need more visual equipment. We have established large interactive TV panels that have more information presented through a visual means. We have also established an environment where students have the capabilities for communication to learn. In the classroom, as we set that up, we have designed classrooms in a way where students can access information in a semicircle instead of a traditional classroom style. So our classrooms are set up differently and adapted to what our students need. So the classroom is set up on based on the students that are in that class.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. That was very comprehensive and I think very important for us to learn as we understand the needs of these students of ours.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, when you took the tour, and I did not make that, did you see the new oven from a couple years ago?
Yes,
and
we did.
They used their money very prudently because I remember a few years ago, and I forget what the request was for. I know I've said this before. It was to replace the oven that went back to President Calvin Coolidge's day. So it had to be the 1920s. So we've kind of thought every 80, 90 years, there should be maybe an oven replaced. And so
whether it needs it or not.
Right,
yes.
Exactly.
I
so,
agree.
I attest to their the very frugal use of dollars. So thank you.
Yes, yes. Yes, and we did all behold the oven. It is lovely and working fine as far as I know.
Still is, yes.
Good, good. Any other questions? All right. Mr. Wilding, any final comments?
Sure. Just as you talked about improvements to our campus, it is important. Our campus is very old, especially at the deaf school. Some of the buildings are over 100, 125 years old. So we are having a difficult time for us maintaining those and keeping them current. as we meet the ADA requirements, the accessibility requirements, and it is a challenge for us every day to keep an eye on our dollars. So I appreciate that you see that in our request, that $250,000 to make sure those are to improve the safety of our buildings for our students, make them more accessible. And that is always an ongoing maintenance need for us because of our buildings and how aged they are. As you have approved our capital bonding project for the new dorm, that building will be starting next week. We look for the demolishing of the old building, but our overall maintenance needs are definitely a consideration. If you have any time you would like to come down and visit, we are willing to set up that time and guide you through a tour of both of our campuses. We do have two campuses. They're about 1 mile apart from each other. So really it's easy for you to come down and see both campuses, see our students, our programs, and what we provide. You're welcome anytime.
Thank you very much. I do hope we have time to do that this year. Thank you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you all.
All right, and let's see. I'll just call down the next three people I have listed, and so if you're not first, you'll know that you'll be coming next. Sam Walseth, Minnesota Rural Education Association. Dan Payan, Director of Finance, South Washington County Schools, representing Minnesota Association of School Business Officials. And Claire Sanford, Minnesota Child Care Association.
Chair Lewin Committee, I'm not Sam Walseth. I'm substituting for him. I'm Fred Nolan, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Rural Education Association. And we're very appreciative of Governor Dayton's proposed $600 million target for education, specifically to the 2 and 2 on the formula, and his commitment to the Teachers Retirement Fund. A strong, solvent TRA is one of the most fundamental recruiting tools a rural school system has to attract and retain teachers for a defined benefit retirement plan. The governor's proposals to create a fairer state share of school facilities are of very high importance to rural schools and their communities. The property tax credits for agriculture production land, known as Ag to School, and his improvements in debt service equalization are very much needed reforms that will help rural education move forward in facility planning on a much more equitable basis, and we're very pleased that they're in the tax committee and part of the tax bill as it is tax policy. With the rollout of voluntary pre-K last year, we saw an outstanding, almost amazing number of rural school districts apply for that with limited funds. Family incomes across rural Minnesota are half the average of those of the metro, and some rural areas suffer from deep poverty. But even those that don't have deep poverty, they have many families just above the free and reduced lunch cutoff for the scholarships. And so a free access program such as voluntary pre-K helps all the families in those communities. These communities could help use state's help to expand those early learning. The dearth of child care in rural areas is well cited. The Center for Rural Policy and Development produced a report last fall to call the situation a quiet crisis. The lack of state investment in child care assistance programs, CCAP, is not helping. Rural economic development interests are turned to school districts to expand pre-K and child care services. Still, the economies and provider pipeline and early childhood staffing are still developing. We are concerned that without a concerted effort to grow early childhood teacher pipeline, will be set up to fail under the proposed mandate that by 2023, schools must provide licensed teachers in pre-K. You're tackling major issues about teacher licensure and shortages, and we applaud your efforts. But we think those efforts need a little longer time to be accomplished first before new licensing mandates are layered on top of the system. And in QComp, there's a waiting list right now of 14 school districts, charter schools, and service ed districts, and the department is expecting more. We would really hope that you would fund those 14 and some more, and perhaps even fully expand QComp so all the districts in the state can have that accessible pet staff development program. And thank you. I'll be available for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Nolan. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Dan Pine. I serve as the Director of Finance for South Washington County Schools. And I'm here representing Minnesota Association of School Business Officials, known as MASBO. MASBO is an organization of over 600 Minnesota school business professionals. We are the ones who create, monitor the budgets, prepare financial statements, make sure the buildings are heated and cooled, transport the kids, and make sure they're all fed. Thank you for allowing us the opportunity to comment on the governor's budget recommendations. We are very supportive and excited to see proposals to increase the basic formula by 2% each year. Provided inflation remains low, and it has been low the last couple of years, even 2% will help cut into the gap of $550 per student between the rate of inflation and the formula increases over the last 13 years. Also, any increase in special education funding is also very exciting for business managers, as the increases will lessen the strain on our general fund budgets. The current cross-subsidy from general education dollars is about $500 per student, meaning special education funding does not cover the cost of all the mandated services, which means that we use our general fund dollars to supplement that. Any progress on debt service equalization, as the governor has proposed $20 million, will help to create a more level playing field and get us closer to having a state where generating the same revenue in any district requires the same property tax effort, regardless of overall property value. We also believe in the importance of preschool programming. Unfortunately, funding is not always available to allow all children who need access to have the access. The proposal to increase funding by $74 million will help create more access, will help those districts who expend general fund dollars to subsidize their pre-K programs. For example, in our district, and albeit our district has a very large budget, over $200 million, our general fund subsidizes between transportation and direct subsidies about $500,000 to our preschool program. MASBO has always included in its platform a plea to invest in MDE infrastructure. We are bean counters and we like computers. Unfortunately, the Department of Education's infrastructure, their complex computers, will be used to report MDE and to calculate state aid and federal aid, are very antiquated and old. We fully support the recommendations to invest money into the upgrade these systems. And finally, the pension situation with TRA. After studying proposals in consultation with TRA, we realize we need to keep the fund solvent. We understand the need to increase the contribution rates. The governor's proposal to offset the employee contribution with $68 million in aid, we fully support this, and in fact, is the only way our budgets could tolerate such a budget increase. If there was not corresponding aid to take care of a 1% increase in TRA, for instance, in our district, we would have to lay off 14 teachers to pay the increase. This would be a new financial mandate that would not increase our services provided, and we are asking that this increase of aid to offset the pension increase would not reduce basic formula aid. Thank you for your time today, and happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Pine. And Mr. Nolan, I was going to do a couple of you and then go to questions. So just to be prepared in case there's questions for you. I think let's go ahead and hear Ms. Sanford, and then we'll open it up for questions for those three testifiers. Ms. Sanford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. I apologize to those members who have already had their fill of me in other committee hearings today. My name is Claire Sanford, and I represent the Minnesota Child Care Association. This is a statewide association of about 250 child care centers, ranging from small single-site locations to large multi-site organizations. I would like to address two specific portions of this bill, voluntary pre-K or VPK and early learning scholarships. Our association continues to support targeted funding for our highest-risk young children over more universal approaches that focus only on the year before kindergarten. We were hopeful, however, about VPK's initial implementation this year. Targeting the funds specifically to low-income children was an improvement, as was the possibility of a mixed delivery system where families could access VPK services at a range of providers that met their needs. The initial implementation, however, of the program has been disappointing. First, MDE is not able to tell us how many new children are being served by the VPK funds, as there was no prohibition on using these funds for children already receiving pre-K services within districts. Second, the mixed delivery idea has not materialized. Of the districts funded, I believe only two are using a community partner, and those are both Head Start programs. In fact, MDE actually found a glitch in the language regarding the calculation of poverty rates in last year's applications that effectively knocked districts who did apply for a mixed delivery partnership out of the running for VPK funds. And we are happy to see that this bill includes language that MDE committed to getting in there to fix that. So that's nice to see. Licensed teachers, as has been mentioned, are also reinserted into the bill as a VPK requirement. And with no research to confirm that a license correlates to improved early childhood outcomes, there is research that a bachelor's degree for an early childhood teacher is correlated to positive outcomes, and that's a standard the early childhood industry is working towards. We prefer the current language allowing for other paths of qualifying as VPK teachers that allow our field to keep the incredible diversity of staff we enjoy. 96% of licensed teachers are white, which does not reflect the low-income populations of students in our state. And finally, I'd like to clarify something in the governor's fact sheet on expanding access, early childhood access and choice, which says that families using VPK could save over $11,000 a year in child care costs. This is misleading at best. Full-time, year-round, center-based child care costs an average of $11,000 in Minnesota. This is for families using over 2,200 hours per year. This is over six times more hours than the VPK requirement of 350 hours per year. An analysis of VPK applications found that programs were providing an average of 450 service hours a year. That works out to an hourly cost of $18.23. The Community Child Care Center cost per hour for pre-K services is $5.03 an hour. And those services are supporting working parents full-time, year-round, not on a school year schedule. A full-time working family, even if they access VPK for 2.5 hours a day for part year, will still need to pay for child care services for all that wraparound care, and that will cost nearly as much as the full-time rates in a community-based program would have cost. Finally, I'd like to make a brief comment on early learning scholarships. We are thrilled with the governor's policy language to expand eligibility down from only 3- and 4-year-olds to birth to 5-year-olds. We know the achievement gap is findable as early as infancy and toddlerhood, so earlier is better. And we're thrilled with that, but we also need to fund it, which the governor's budget doesn't do. It expands the language, but not the funding. So we would encourage you to please invest more in the early learning scholarship program. Thank you.
Thank you. I would open up to questions for any of the three testifiers. We had Mr. Nolan or Mr. Pine or Ms. Sanford. All right. Apparently you have awed them all. So thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. All right. Dr. Walter Roberts, Minnesota School Counselors Association. And on deck will be Kimberly Antonson, Kickstart teacher. All right. Dr. Roberts, welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's very good to see many friends that I've had the opportunity to work with over the past few years, and I look forward to meeting those of you who are new. My name is Walter Roberts, Jr. I am a professor of counselor education at Minnesota State University, Mankato, and today I am wearing two hats. I am speaking today both as a counselor educator and then also as a representative of the Minnesota School Counselors Association. I'm also very happy to be here. This week, this is National School Counseling Week, so it makes a wonderful time for us to be here and answer any questions that you may have at the conclusion of my prepared remarks. As you know, the Minnesota School Counselors Association represents about 1,000 licensed professional counselors throughout the state, and many times school counselors are the first point of contact for families and students whenever they have issues related to academics, personal social issues, and or all the all-important career choices and post-secondary educational opportunity issues. And in this day and age, with regard to the issues that we're facing with the workforce needs, we believe that our work is even more important than it has been in many, many years. School counselors, however, do not act alone, and I want to make that very clear that I am not here just talking about school counselors. Every day, school counselors work in collaboration with other student support staff, and we're talking about school social workers, school psychologists, school nurses, and chemical dependency counselors, and all of us work together to ensure that students get the support that they need to help them achieve successfully in the classroom. Research has shown and continues to show that individuals who receive supports both in and outside the classroom may have access to comprehensive student support services. We see a decrease in disciplinary suspension rates, an increase in attendance and graduation rates, increased math and proficiency scores, as well as increased post-secondary enrollment and career awareness and readiness. Counselors and related support staff play a critical role as well in addressing the state's persistent achievement gap. Unfortunately, too many students are forced to wait for days or even weeks sometimes to receive the services that would assist them in the classroom and or the other issues that impact them academically. The average school counselor caseload in Minnesota hovers somewhere around three times the national levels, as is recommended by national standards. We are grateful. School counselors across this state, and I think I can also say other student support services, are extremely grateful to the Minnesota legislature and Governor Dayton for recognizing how serious this problem is, and for last year investing $12 million in the Support Our Students grant program. This groundbreaking program allowed school districts to apply for matching funds for a six-year grant to hire student support staff, including, of course, but not limited to school counselors. It is mandate-free, no one had to apply, and it maintains that all-important critical local control element that we know that our school districts rely on very heavily to provide the services that are needed within their particular districts. I'm here today to tell you that the Support Our Students grant program was an overwhelming success. And for those of you who were here last year, I want you to know that, how successful this program has been. We were able to hire 77 school districts across the state. We were able to hire 77 new support staff positions across the state, 40 of which were school counseling positions. You have a handout in your packet that shows you some of the areas where student support staff were hired, as well as the different particular focus areas that the school district hired for their particular region. And if you need more details, I can certainly get you that after this testimony is over. The positions were split primarily equally between Greater Minnesota and Urban Minnesota, and that was one of the critical things that we want to stress, is that we are very concerned about the needs of Greater Minnesota, rural Minnesota, when it comes to children having access to the support services that they need. Despite the funding, however, for these new positions, Minnesota's standings still, unfortunately, rank toward the bottom when it comes to providing school counseling services. And as we know from studies that were done last year, the state is basically spending less than half of the national average overall in student support services. We believe that we must do better in order to help our students be as successful as possible, because we know that student support helps students academically in the classroom. We thank Governor Dayton for understanding the importance of the Support Our Students initiative and for including an additional $4 million in one-time funding for the Support Our Students grant program. However, helping our students in the long term requires more than just the one-term action. It would take at least 20 years of funding at the rate that was provided in the 2016 supplemental budget for Minnesota to reach just the national average of, with regard to the national average that you see nationwide for school counselors across the country. We look forward to working with the members of this committee and the entire legislation in a bipartisan fashion, and I really want to stress this. We see this as a bipartisan issue. This is not a one particular party's issue over another. This is about our kids, and so we look forward to working in a bipartisan fashion to find some of the solutions for those long-term student support needs. We want to ensure that every Minnesota student and their families have the support that they need to be successful both in the classroom and as a part of our state's future workforce. I also want to recognize Representative Tice and other members of the committee today who have graciously agreed to be sponsors and co-authors on a bill that is introduced for the Support Our Students grant program, and of course we will be working very closely with you as this bill moves forward. I thank you very much for your time today. I know oftentimes you have testimony. You have a lot of people who come in here and they throw a lot of complaints at you, but I hope that basically the takeout that you get from this message is that the Support Our Students grant program has been incredibly successful, and we hope that we'll be able to continue that. And I'll answer any questions that you have, and if I need to get follow-up information, I'll be sure to do that. So thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Dr. Roberts. We do have a couple of questions. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Roberts, could you tell us how the counselor with the other
support service
people in a school district assesses a student for special needs or for autism or dyslexia or ADHD or mental health issues, how they're assessed and then how they're followed up once they've been assessed with community programs?
I think a part of what the effort is with regard to the student support services bill is to provide that teamwork among all of the student support services. Oftentimes, concerns about student behaviors or their academic progress comes from the teacher in the classroom. It may show up with a parent-teacher conference with a school counselor or with the teacher. At that point in time, then, there may be referrals that are made to other members of the team if those individuals are available to begin the testing process. We all know that there are individuals within our schools who require additional services, more intensive needs. However, the student support teams are there to help in the early identification process to help get those individuals and their families the services that may be needed. Obviously, of course, there's special education testing that's going to come about. The support network is there to provide and I go back to that support. We like to see student support services as a safety net to try to support individuals who otherwise might be missed in the regular academic classroom, to support them so that they will be academically successful. So special education testing process and referral mechanism, oftentimes student support service staff are directly involved in that as one component or another.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Dr. Roberts, so how does this work then? Yesterday, the person that testified on behalf of the counselors said about 20% of the time, and I got this was more in high school or middle school and high school, mm-hmm. about 20% of the time they got to do real counseling. And a large number of, it seemed to me, of the time is spent doing testing or scheduling kind of mm-hmm. things. So how can we do the identifying and the assessments, especially if the counselors aren't employed all the way from early childhood all the way through high school? And there's fewer, I believe, in elementary school than in the higher years. So how can we ever catch up, even if we have that 20-year gap taken care of? What hope do we have, Dr. Roberts?
Madam Chair and Representative Burke, I'm full of hope. I think you raise a very good question, clearly, that, will we ever catch up unless we infuse a huge amount of money into this? And the answer is, I don't know what the answer to that is. I think that, clearly, student support staffs many times are overwhelmed with just caseloads. If you look at school nursing in particular, I think their caseloads are probably 1,000 to one. School counselors in Minnesota, their caseloads oftentimes are, average K-12 or somewhere close to 800 to one. Clearly, that's too many. I think what we have to do is, and that's a goal of the student support grant program, is to give local school districts the opportunity to try to, begin that stopgap measure. This is a beginning. And I really don't have a clear answer, because I know that the legislature doesn't have a money pot, and I don't have a money pot that we can just throw money everywhere. But we here's what we do know. If we don't do something, the situation will only get worse. My wife is a kindergarten teacher. She sees kids coming into the classroom every year with greater and greater and greater needs. You talk to elementary teachers, they will tell you kids are coming in with a higher level of need. They need that support in order to help them learn in the classroom. You know, I'm not going to be Pollyanna about this. I'm very realistic. We have to continue we have to move in the direction that we're moving now, because if we don't, the situation is only going to get worse. We know it's not going to get any better, and my concern is that it will get worse.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, I have hope too. Mm-hmm.
Representative Poston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Roberts, on your handout, this little box that says, do you know, and you mentioned it earlier, that it's going to take 20 years at the current funding to catch up to the national average. We had a very experienced counselor here testify yesterday that told us that 1 to 450 even is not a very good ratio. So we're further off than 20 years if that's the case. My question to you is the same thing that I asked him yesterday. What is the right ratio in your mind?
Madam Chair and Representative Poston, and thank you for being a co-signer on the bill, by the way. That's going to vary by district, I think. And that's a part of why we left local control here. Some districts may have greater needs and may need a larger, a more intensive support staff across the board. I can tell you from experience, in one of my past lives, I like to say I had a real job. I was a school counselor in a 7 through 12 setting. And the numbers that I had hovered around 300 to 350. I think that it clearly, at the elementary level, the numbers typically are larger because there's more classroom provision of information, and as students move up middle school and high school, those numbers, typically what you'll see in schools, the ratios drop. So what is the magic number? I know what the recommendation is. The recommendation is 250 to 1. I don't believe that's realistic. I think that most school counselors in the state would tell you if they had an average caseload of 350, they'd be really happy. But again, that's statewide. We have some schools who have very small caseloads for their counselors because of the nature of the school. And then we have others that have, you know, we have school counselors who have very, very large caseloads, you know, 800. They do have that 800, or they have 1,000. This is particularly critical in rural schools, where you many times may have only one member of the student support team to be the one that is that first contact, whether it's a school counselor or a school social worker, a school nurse, or whatever, you know, whatever their particular function is. But the focus of this bill is to provide give school districts the opportunity to provide a comprehensive effort so that students can have their needs met by one of the hopefully by all of the professions. So the magic number is, you can wiggle for school district.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Other questions? I had a question. I'm not sure if you're the right person to direct it to, and I know Mr. Uni's here from the department, so I may call you forward to add. But one of the things I've been trying to look at is, and I know we've talked about this sort of where Minnesota ranks on the counselors before, and this has been a recurrent issue and a point of concern for the committee, but not every school reports exactly the same way, or not every state does. And I'm just wondering if, in talking about these positions, if it's just the people categorized as a school counselor that we're reporting and our numbers look so bad, but we have other support staff that may be categorized different. I'm just trying to get a full picture of where Minnesota sits.
And, Madam Chair, I'm not the expert. I mean, how that is tabulated is going to be a question that MDE probably be in a position to answer. I will say that there has been a history in this state of, I think, some of the reporting data being some somewhat squishy with regard to what school districts have chosen to call a school counselor. And that can be problematic.
I think
that's being cleaned up now, but
And Mr. Ernie, if you have anything to add to this, if you want to come up. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. My name is Ado Shuni. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Minnesota Department of Education. Thank you for the question, and it's a very good one. I don't have the answer now, but I can certainly go back and talk to our teams that would be most closely associated with counselors and support staff. Many years ago, our department had staff dedicated to this issue area, and we no longer have staff exclusively dedicated to support staff personnel. I will also connect with our licensing department to see if our STAR reporting data system does collect data on these support personnel, as well as obviously teachers, which is the main focus of that, or if we track personnel in any other manner. I can get back to the committee with that information.
Thank you. I think that would be helpful, as I know this is going to be a topic we're going to continue to discuss, and so I think that information would be helpful for the committee. Thank you. Any other questions for Dr. Roberts? All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Roberts.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
All right. Let's see. And Kimberly Antonson, Kickstart teacher from Wavan Ogima White Earth Schools. Welcome to the committee. If you please just state your name for the record, and we welcome your testimony.
Hello, my name is Kimberly Ann Thompson. I am a teacher at the Wavan Ogima White Earth School District.
Thank you for correcting my pronunciation.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for giving me time to speak today. Like I said, my name is Kimberly Ann Thompson. My kids know me as Miss Kimberly. I have been a licensed teacher for 18 years, and I have been a licensed preschool teacher for 16 years. I am the chairperson of Education Minnesota's ECFE and ABE task force, and I was just recently appointed to the Governor's Early Learning Council. I'm a preschool teacher in the Wavan Ogima White Earth School District in northern Minnesota. I'm here today to talk in support of the Governor's proposal for additional pre-K funding. In Ogima, we are a pre-K to fourth grade school. 3 years ago, I was hired there because they were changing to all-day, every-day preschool. This was very groundbreaking in my area. Larger schools close by were not even considering this. The district added 3 preschool-specific classrooms and an indoor play area just for our preschoolers. The first 2 years, our 2 classrooms were full and had a waiting list that could fill a third room. However, we did not have the funds to do so, despite my school district using funds from the general ed funding also, besides just early childhood and community ed funds. Just a few weeks before the start of this school year, we are excited to receive the state's voluntary pre-K funding. With that money, we were able to add the 3rd preschool classroom with a licensed and highly qualified teacher. Thank you all for that. I'm very passionate about my job. However, this year the job got even more personal for me. My son is currently enrolled in our 3rd classroom. Before this year, I was considering waiting another year for him to go to kindergarten. He was just not interested in academics, and he has a March birthday. This year has sparked that interest in him. He can write his name and tell me how to spell it. He picks out letters of his friend's name. He counts to 20. He knows his colors and all his shapes. He talks nonstop on our drives home about what he did at school. Most importantly, he wants to go to school. He was going to daycare before, and there were days he didn't want to go to daycare. But these days, he wants to go to school. Preschool gives kids the foundation in which their educational careers are built on. We not only need to give our youngest learners these opportunities, but we also must regulate them to make sure that children are learning in a developmentally appropriate way. They should not be sitting at tables listening to a teacher lecture. They should be exploring a room that has been set up with consideration to their needs and wants. If you want to see what a developmentally appropriate classroom looks like, I invite you to come visit my school and see all the good your funding is creating. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Antonson. Any questions for this witness? Thank you. Well, thank you very much for being here. I hope your son always loves school.
Me too.
It's a great thing.
Thank you.
Patrice Howard, Director of Community Schools and Partnerships from Brooklyn Center. Welcome. If you please just state your name for the record and then provide your testimony.
Patrice Howard. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for allowing us to speak to you today. My name is Patrice Howard. I'm representing Brooklyn Center Community Schools as the Director of Community Schools and Partnerships. Brooklyn Center Schools is the state's first full-service community school district with over 100 partnerships and programs that respond to the needs of the whole child by helping to reduce barriers to learning. We began implementation of this model in 2009 and have produced positive results ever since. Graduation rates in 2014 and 15 were 87%, up 74% from 2010. The percentage of our students enrolling in Minnesota post-secondary institution increased from 61% to 78% in 2013. We are confident that this number will increase through coordination and partnerships. We also continue to experience a decrease in behavior referrals as well as absenteeism. Additionally, we have increased family engagement practices, increased support for families such as food, mental health, and medical support, including enrichment programs that is supported by our first-ever community school site coordinator, which is a recipient and product of our first-time funding for full-service community schools. I can go on and on about this model and its positive results, and it's over 50 years of research, but today I will spare your time and offer up my greatest gratitude for the support of the governor's proposal to increase the formula and additional funding for student support services. Funding for full-service community schools is needed to support sustainability of on-site coordination, which is the critical piece of this work, and that having an on-site site coordinator, who is responsible for the coordination and services and supports. Funding will also support other districts interested in this model, as well as support for technical assistance at the state level. Because of our experience, Brooklyn Center has often posed as the state technical assistance provider. However, having someone designated at the state will allow us to better support those that are ready to implement. Once again, I want to thank you for your support, and as always, I would like to invite you out to visit us or one of our collaborators in this work. Several other school districts are now interested, and we would love to have you come out and see the wonderful things that we're doing with our beautiful children. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Howard. I appreciate it. I think we might have a question for you. Representative Erickson, did you have a question?
Madam Chair, this question is probably for Mr. Strong. When Brooklyn Center became our first community school in partnership, did the state put any dollars into that initiation of that concept?
Mr. Strong.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I'm afraid I don't know. I know the... I better check. I don't want to tell you wrong. I don't know the answer.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Howard.
In 2009, we became the first pilot. There were no monies allocated to us at that time.
That's what I thought. Thank you.
Thank you.
But we'll double check anyway.
We will. And Ms. Howard, do you happen to know how the school district managed to start this without funds, or did they get private or outside funds?
We went out to just secure partnerships. Our former superintendent, Keith Lester, connected with a number of local organizations and agencies, and we did a number of needs assessments, including a two-year community needs assessments, and that's how we got our start.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Madam Chair, yes, Keith Lester was an innovator. He's one of my former superintendents, and when he left Mora and took on this obligation, this was his goal, and he did it very effectively so that you could begin that without a state investment. So we know that we can have this without state money if you have an innovative leader and supportive community.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Howard? Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Howard,
I appreciated the outcome data that you shared in terms of graduation rates, onboarding higher education. I forget the phrase you used, but also the decreased absenteeism and decreased behavioral referrals, because I think if you can decrease the latter two, you increase the first two, probably fit together. But can you just talk about how the student's experience is different in a full-service community school that then yields decreased absenteeism, decreased behavioral referrals, higher graduation and matriculation rates?
Sure. Madam Chair, committee members, I can try to the best as I can. I can tell you that the overall culture of the school and the climate changes. By having a site coordinator on site allows us to establish a number of connections with support services as well as on-site partnerships. Those on-site partnerships allow us to better respond to the needs. So what that means is we have a number of opportunities that we can redirect negative behaviors and use it as a way of intervention and exposing kids to a number of opportunities that have served as beneficial. So we have over 500 students in our high school out of 900 at this point in time of year that are participating in our out-of-school time programs that can go on till 9 o'clock at night and also on weekends. We also have a number of on-site medical services that really respond to some of these. We know that through a number of research studies, case studies, that a number of kids have received negative referrals because of a health issue and not knowing how to appropriately articulate that. But having on-site mental health providers and being able to address those needs right there has positively impacted that number, if that addresses your question.
Representative Dabney.
Not a bad shot. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Sansed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Howard, did I hear you correctly when you said you had over 100 partnerships?
And programs, yes.
And programs. And that's, I think you spoke to it, not just with the community, but on-site as well.
That's correct, Madam Chair, committee members. Yes.
I just want to say thank you for paving the way and congratulations. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Howard. Thank you for being here. And like Representative Erickson, I also know Superintendent Keith Lester well, quite a visionary leader and kind of a force of nature,
yes.
Quite frankly. I do remember those years for your school district. If I'm not mistaken, I don't think I am. I think the school district was the statutory operating that at that time. Thanks to some changes that we did here, including changes with integration aid, that school district is no longer in statutory operational debt. But, Madam Chair, you know, the vision of that community of folks to just do the right thing while they were struggling, you know, with just their basic operations is really nothing short of amazing. It seems to me that that your school district had some great advantages, nonetheless.
Mm-hmm.
That other school districts around the state, particularly in Greater Minnesota, may not have. You know, you're in a densely, you know, populated urban center, so you know the ability to connect with, you know, with multiple providers, both in public and private sector, you know, delivery of services, healthcare,
mm-hmm.
for instance, that at least numerically that was there for your school district. I'm not sure that that's always there for school districts all around the state. And it seems to me that's kind of the point of the governor's idea here, which is it shouldn't just be the luck of the draw, if you will, that a school district is in the midst of, you know, a whole bunch of services that currently aren't connected to schools that should be, that whether a school district, you know, has that kind of access immediately, you know, apparent, that particular school district shouldn't do without. And it seems to me that there's some really important seed investment that's being proposed here by the governor to further move along school districts and geographics where those relationships aren't apparent or easily made as they were in Brooklyn Center. My question to you on that is, what have you done in your school district, if anything, in terms of being able to share your practices with school districts around the state? Has that happened? Is there promise and is there interest in that?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Howard.
Chair, committee members. Yes, I mentioned in my testimony that we have since posed as a technical assistance provider for the state, meaning that we know that no one community school looks alike, and it's based on your needs assessment, and that's why the site coordinator is so crucial to this work, that site coordinator actually implements the needs assessment. And that needs assessment is really going to identify what the need of the school is. So you're going to have a rural school that their need may be enrichment programs. You may find 10 miles away or 20 miles away that there's actually an agency, YMCA, if you will, that is interested in partnering, but no one has actually made that connection. And that's the goal, and that's the role of the site coordinator, is getting out there and really, in a way, community organizing and doing those things and alleviating the additional stressors and tasks and just daily roles of a teacher, that they can actually focus on instructional and quality curriculum, opposed to actually posing as a social worker. That community school site coordinator is the crucial piece in doing that. And so what we do at Brooklyn Center Community Schools is we offer tours. My staff and I assist other school districts and community organizations in the needs assessment. The technical assistance that we receive is from the National Coalition for Community Schools. So we take that and then use that as just guidance and a template to help others who are interested in this work. So we're doing a number of things. We're getting out. We're visiting site councils. We're offering tours. We're volunteering. We're doing a lot of community organizing. So whatever we can, we don't feel like there's any direct competition. We want to make sure that services are accessible for young people and families so that they can have a chance at a quality life as well.
Thank you. Representative Moran. And Ms. Howard, just a question. It occurred to me as you were talking that these site coordinators are doing something a little bit unique in mm-hmm. terms of what their services are. What kind of person do you seek for that? I mean, is this a licensed teacher that now has this position of coordinating community services, or is there some kind of particular skills or qualifications for this position?
Madam Chair, committee members, yes, it's not necessarily a licensed teacher, but I think having a licensed teacher does have some perks because they've been in the classrooms most times, so they can identify what those needs are and have some keen sense on what to look for in identifying possible partnerships. What we look for and what we provide guidance on for others that are interested in this work is finding someone who has a background in youth development, family and community engagement, public health. This model is really connected to public health. Those who actually know the work of civic engagement as well, so it's just a wide spectrum, and we're available to support guidance and professional development in that area.
Thank you very much. That was helpful information. Any other questions for Ms. Howard? All right. Thank you very much for being here.
Please come visit.
Thank you. All right. Let's see. I hope I'm pronouncing this right. Nate Mathias, a pre-K teacher. All right. And then Dr. Thine with St. Paul Public Schools. I have you on deck. So just so you know, you're coming next. Mr. Mathias, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nate Mathias. I'm a pre-K teacher in the West Metro area. I have a teaching license and a master's in education from the U of M. And in my decade of teaching experience, I have taught inside and out of our state, taught in special ed and social studies classrooms, and now work in an elementary school teaching pre-K. And I'm here to share my experiences that have led me to understand how impactful the year before kindergarten can be for a child's learning and development, and why it should be school-based and available to all Minnesotan children, no matter their parents' income or zip code. When I heard I had the chance to testify before the committee about why I'm so passionate about bringing pre-K to every Minnesotan child, so many stories came to mind. I wondered which story best illustrates the impact my experience I've seen over the years. I have stories of the ultra-challenging students who have made dramatic improvements in behavior that their parents so desperately hoped their child would be able to achieve. I've experienced these success stories thanks in many ways to our school district's forward-thinking philosophy to have every child in the district kindergarten ready through high-quality early education, and their help in facilitating collaboration with early childhood special education services. Then I thought of the amazing stories I can tell about the high-flying students who entered my class as four-year-olds, already kindergarten-ready academically. There are children entering my classroom each year excelling in proficiency, with some reading nearly as well as their older siblings. I used to wonder how I'd be able to progress to proficient while still ensuring that my entire class was kindergarten-ready by the end of the school year. It would be extremely difficult for me to progress every student, especially those early high flyers, without the access I'm afforded to reading resource libraries, our school library, and other elementary school students to have as role models and to serve as mentors for my students. Then I thought of the stories I have each year of the children who arrive in my classroom on day one with very little exposure to letters, numbers, holding a pencil, or even interacting with their peers. These children, depending on the socioeconomics of the area you teach, can already be entering pre-K far behind their peers in many ways. These gaps only compound if children are missing out on quality pre-K because their parents cannot afford to send their children more than a couple of days a week. It is almost parent-teacher conference season, and each year I'm uplifted by the parents who see the incredible growth in their child and say, "This was the best investment we've ever made for our kids." But then I'm also crushed by the parents who are seeing the benefits and glowing about how much their child loves being in my class, but cannot afford to pay for another day of pre-K despite their strong desire to send them every day. This is heartbreaking to hear, but it tells me we're making an impact thanks to the benefits of being part of an elementary school. We have music in the music room, we check out books, we use the gym, the playgrounds, and eat in the cafeteria with the kindergartners. This gives every child so much confidence in themselves, and I see positively the impact that it has on their learning in so many ways. These success stories and incredible gains are unlikely to occur for all Minnesotan children if the legislature does not act to support the availability of school-based pre-K for every child. I believe my classroom experience and the trends of the years of assessments have helped me to understand why pre-K for every child is so important. There are the families that have yet to feel the impact of a quality pre-K program, so they may be unaware of the access issues or perhaps the future impact on their children's learning and therefore the importance of funding pre-K in our state's budget. The state government is here to provide things we deem a public good, and there is no other area I've witnessed where we can do more good with a little investment in our kids. Thank you so much for your time and willingness to take testimony on this important issue. And if you have any questions, I'd love to answer them if I can. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mathias. We greatly appreciate you being here. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say I think you might be the first male pre-K teacher I have met. I think that's awesome. So thank you. Thank you for being here. Any questions? Wonderful. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Fine?
Madam Chair, Dr. Fine got held up and he can't be here right now.
Okay.
And I don't know if it would be okay. I ran into Brenda Nutella, who was asked to come down on behalf of her colleagues to talk about the Pelmy Grove. And she's also from St. Paul, so would you mind if we just, I'll be very brief.
Sure, that would be fine. Okay. So are you both going to talk, or whoever wants to lead off, just please introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for being flexible and allowing me to talk. My name is Brenda Natala, and I'm one of the special education administrators for St. Paul Schools. I supervise the early childhood special education program, and I'm also talking on behalf of all of the other administrators that work with early childhood special education programs across the state. I'm going to give you a snapshot of our district, but the same thing would apply whether it's a rural district with the challenges of geography and low numbers of staff, or whether it's an urban district with the challenges that we face. And so I'd like to speak on behalf of expanding Help Me Grow. Currently, Help Me Grow is a referral service. It's a phone number that's called, and school districts get the referral, and we immediately respond to the referral using special education staff. And I'm going to speak on behalf of birth to three programs that are statewide and also include 3 to 5 year old preschool programs. And so really when we talk about student support, like my counselor colleagues talked about, I'm talking about how are we starting that support from birth and how are we supporting families and children so that they're ready for school and so that we prevent special education services once they enter school, if we can. In St. Paul, we have about 70% of our students qualify for free and reduced lunch, and about 40% are English language learners where English isn't spoken at home. In our birth to three program, we have about 40 licensed teachers, very highly qualified. Some even have their doctorates. Most have their masters. And every year we get over 1,000 referrals. We get 90 referrals a month for birth to three age students through our program. Of those referrals, about 58% of those referrals, either the parents say we're not concerned or we're not able to reach the parent because perhaps they moved or their phone was shut off or something happened where we're not able to follow up. Child protection system mandates that referrals are made to Part C before a child protection case is closed, and we are required to follow up on those referrals. And that is part of why a high rate of our referrals do not result in a situation where a family wants or needs services from special education staff. Only 16% of the referrals that are made for birth to three services for St. Paul schools end up in eligibility for special education early intervention. So our staff, 84% of the referrals that come in, our staff have to take the time as experts, educational specialists, to review those referrals, to talk with the parents, to make a determination if the child truly needs special education services. So 84% of the work that's being done is not resulting in actual early intervention services. And I believe that an expanded Help Me Grow would help referrals come in to an expanded referral system that would allow referrals to go to all the different agencies that can support families and children. We know that families in our community have a high need for housing support. They have a very high need to access Social Security services and health care services and figure out if they're eligible for MA or not, or if their eligibility has stopped, and to figure that out. Child care subsidies, all of the high needs that young families in our community have. And I would assert that that's not best done by staff who are paid through special education funding, that special education staff should be spending the majority of their time providing early intervention and to help a child's development progress. Just to give you a story, I was recently out on a home visit with the teacher who was working with a family, a recent refugee family. The father had been in the military in his home country, and the mother had a severe mental illness, and the child had a pretty significant developmental delay, a baby who wasn't walking yet and who wasn't sitting up. And the father's main concern was that he had gotten letters in the mail from his health insurance, and he couldn't understand whether if his health insurance had been canceled or not. And so the majority of the time that could have been spent in helping the child learn and develop was spent on with our interpreter and the teacher helping the father understand the paperwork that he'd gotten in the mail. So if we had an expanded Help Me Grow system where we could connect families with service coordination that they need to get the health care and the child care and the social services they need, that would really take the burden off of public school systems so that we could do a better job of providing the early intervention that we are trained to do. For 3 to 5 year old preschool programs, we also get another 1,000 referrals a year for 3 to 5 year olds. About 35% of those 1,000 plus referrals result in eligibility for special education. So we welcome referrals. We want more referrals. We want more appropriate referrals. We are not finding all of the children that we need to find in our community. We are still finding that children come to pre-K, 4-year-old pre-K, and kindergarten who have never been screened, who have significant needs. So we are definitely advocating for more referrals. We want the referrals to be able to be sorted and kind of triaged with an expanded Help Me Grow so that we can be most efficient with our resources to address those concerns. This year, for example, in our pre-K program, 21% of the children who showed up for pre-K on day one had not ever gone through early childhood screening. So then we're playing catch-up, and we're hopeful that with an expanded Help Me Grow, we could have families have a more streamlined and efficient way to get access to services. It would also help our staff to have an expanded Help Me Grow system so that our staff could better access and connect with other systems. If someone at kind of the state level is coordinating, is pulling that information together and having a resource base that staff can access, it would also help our work so that we're not trying to reinvent the wheel locally.
Thank you, Ms. Nutella. I do have a question, or did you want to offer testimony first, Ms. Gilbert?
No, go for it.
Okay. Representative Grisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Nutella, is that right? Just quickly, you had a lot there, but I just wanted to focus on one thing that I heard and make sure I heard it right. Mm-hmm. You talked about the child protection screening and that, and mm-hmm. I want to make sure I get this right because I reviewed it on another side. There seems to be a parallel screening process that the Department of Education has where it sounds like schools can go through that with county social workers. I'm looking for your opinion, or I'm looking for some direction here. We've often questioned that dual system, wondering if we should just move it all back into the counties or if it should exist in both. And maybe that's not what you were getting at, mm-hmm. but I just wanted to, I heard that, so I wanted to make sure I asked that question.
Ms. Nutella.
Yeah, Madam Chair and representatives of the committee. See if I understand the question correctly. I think, so when a referral is made by Child Protection has to make a referral if there's been a case opened with any member of the family and they have a child who's under age 3. We get the referral. Sometimes there's a developmental concern that's been identified by a Child Protection worker through whatever checklist and system they're using, and sometimes there's not a concern identified. Is that part of what you're asking?
Yep.
Representative Grisha.
And just really, I mean, we don't have to spend a lot of time on this. Mm-hmm. So what I'm hearing is there's not immediate duplication, but it's more, and I know there's some onerous stuff that goes on here, there's a lot of burdens, and I'm trying to get to the heart of that too. And you can take this offline and maybe we can circle back. What I'm looking for is making sure there's no duplication, that we're not doing it in two agencies, one in the school, one in the county, and if there's ways that we can reduce some of those loads, because I think we have a lot of people having a lot of conversations, and there's just a lot there. So I would welcome that conversation offline.
Yes. Thank you. Madam Chair, I would agree that we are very happy when any of our partners provide developmental screening. It doesn't necessarily need to be from the school district.
Thank you. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, and I'm excuse me for my ignorance, you say, where are these referrals coming from?
Ms. Nutella.
Madam Chair, the referrals are coming from a variety of sources, physicians, child protection social workers, county social workers, parents make a lot of referrals also, child care providers, preschool teachers, physicians and parents are in the high, and social workers are the top three.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so is some of this the EPSDT screenings that get sent to you? And how does the mental health stuff get identified for you?
Ms. Nutella.
Madam Chair, I don't know that acronym.
It's Medicaid requires every child from birth to 18 to be screened for mental health and other things at various ages. And, you know, what I hear is that school districts are resistant to that because if they go down that path, and it doesn't turn that they have a kind of medical level of mental health issues, but they have other issues that is going to be on the school district's books. And so I'm just curious about how that relates into what the work and some of the referrals. Because I imagine some of these physician referrals are partly because of that.
Ms. Nutella.
Madam Chair, I don't have any data around that. I can say that we very much value the infant mental health work that's being done in the state of Minnesota, and it's very relevant to our work in birth to three. And so I don't think that we've seen that as a problematic issue from the standpoint of birth to three services. I think that we would see any kind of expansion in terms of screening or identification or providing services for mental health that impacts that parent-infant attachment would be a positive.
And does Ms. Gilbert have any, Madam Chair, on that? Because I've been told that you actually are the person that knows about this issue.
Madam Chair and Representative Thiessen, we do the early periodic screening as part of the screening that we do, which includes an assessment as well as a developmental assessment, and that's screened at the same time. I will say that we have focused our screening on that part of the screening on 3- and 4-year-olds, though, because of our ability to provide the screening within the budget limitations that we have, and so we've had to prioritize the screening, and so we focused it on the 3- and 4-year-olds. Once a student arrives in kindergarten, we use the pediatricians, even though it might not be complete and include the whole developmental portion of it, we've just made a determination that we had to prioritize because of resources. And I can get you the number of screening and then the referrals that are done as well.
That would be helpful. Thank you, Representative Thiessen.
I would like to add, I think, I know I sound like a broken record in this committee, but one of the things that we've been working with the Department of Education and the Department of Human Services is currently school districts get reimbursed for assessments they do that are medically necessary that are part of the IEP process if they result in an IEP. This is a very good example of the assessments that school districts are asked to do that are medically necessary that would be reimbursed in the private sector or clinic sector that are not getting currently reimbursed under the system because they don't result in IEP. So I think this is one really ripe area. And we've been told by the national association that works with MA and school-based services and the Department of Human Services that if the assessment is medically necessary and it's done and it's included in the report, that is an eligible reimbursement. And the beauty of that also is that the state can use the special education match as the federal match, so it's something that districts can do that can draw down some additional federal dollars that doesn't have a state cost, which is like, you know, a win-win for the state. So it's just a we are working through that between the two agencies to see if we can get that on in your bill by the time you have that.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Thiessen.
She actually answered the question I should have asked, so thank you.
That's good. Thank you. All right, any further questions?
And then I'll just briefly I don't want to repeat what all the other
okay, just, I'm not sure we had you introduce yourself, so please just do that. And
all right, I'm Mary Gilbert from the St. Paul Public Schools, and Dr. Tyne actually had a student on a school visit last week, asked him if he was Donald Trump. And when he said, "No, I'm not Donald Trump," and the student said, "Are you sure?" And so I just want you to know that I'm sure Dr. Tyne would have preferred to be here today, I'm sure, because he's been a pleasure to have at the school district over the last year. And what he wanted to say was that he wanted to thank you first for the investments that you made in K-12 education in the last biennium and how important it was and the commitment that was made. And I know that people have a little sticker shock about how it carried over into the next biennium, but it was really an important investment. And we're really pleased that the governor actually has a high target for K-12 education again this year, particularly with the Gen Ed formula, the commitment to the special education. In St. Paul, we have a $900 per pupil trust subsidy for our special education, which means that roughly half of our special education budget comes out of regular instruction. And that's a big and substantial chunk. And so we are, as we've gone through budget reductions the last couple of years, we've really tried to keep the cuts away from the classroom. However, it's getting to be more and more and more difficult, especially as the needs of our students have increased. We also are supporting the voluntary pre-K. We do run we are the largest pre-K program in the state. And we have expanded our enrollment from a little over 1,200 in 2009 and 10 to up to 1,900 that will be coming in this year. In addition to having more students, we have more all-day K programs. And as I talked about before in this committee, we do have partnerships with both family child care and corporate child care that we have on a contract basis where the childcare facilities tell us what they want or need, and we provide the services. We are also, our demand is really for more full day, and so that's what parents are asking. That's kind of switched, actually, over the term of our pre-K programming. We also want to mention the, which is not in this committee, but the nearly $75 million increase in the child care assistance. Part of the work that we do with the child care, we found out that we train staff, we provide curriculum, and because of the high turnover within the child care community, they leave. And I'm sure that the child care providers have told you that as well. And I believe that the proposal also will help streamline some of the child care eligibility so that families don't have to sign up every 6 months. I think part of the reason, actually, the scholarship has been so attractive is because you just apply once and you get it for the whole year. And I think there's been some barriers for at-risk families around some of the child care assistance. I will add that the funding for the pension increase is critically important. We just simply cannot take money from our from our classrooms to fund a pension increase, and that we are in full support of all of the other provisions that you've heard from today around full-service community schools, expanding sports services, because we're in the same boat as every other school district with some of the mental health challenges that we have. And the challenges that we have with the new immigrants that are coming to St. Paul as well. Right now we have over 3,500 students that are considered SLIFE. They're kids new to the country with little or no formal education. We've actually added over 1,000 EL kids just since last May to the school district. And primarily they're level one ELL learners, so they come with little or no English or no formal education. So.
Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Let's see. I've got Daniel Gumnett, CEO for People Serving People. And then next, someone from the Children's Defense Fund. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Daniel Gumnett, and I'm the CEO of People Serving People. We're the region's largest and most comprehensive shelter for children and families experiencing homelessness. In 2016, we sheltered more than 2,000 children and their families. The average age at our shelter is 6 years old, and nearly 400 of the children at our shelter attended our four-star parent aware rated program. And for many of those children, it was the first structured learning experience they had experienced. Every day I see the struggle and challenges that parents facing homelessness experience. I know that connecting parents with access to high-quality child care and early education is crucial to the parents and children breaking the cycle of homelessness. I'm here to testify in favor of the Governor Dayton's recommended appropriation of $3 million per biennium to support the expanded Help Me Grow system. It's critical to provide Minnesota families, especially families who've experienced homelessness, an organized support system that can access through a centralized channel as opposed to an a la carte and siloed system. Many families are already working with Help Me Grow in its current form. However, the system has significant limitations to its effectiveness because, as was mentioned earlier, that the funding is provided through Part C ECSE resource. The system currently works to connect children exclusively through school-based programs, special ed services. This committee has demonstrated a strong preference for models that maximize parent choice and empowerment, expanding Help Me Grow's capacity to connect children to families to a wide array of state and locally based resources aligns very closely with this committee's goals. Finally, I want to share with you that there are a large and growing coalition of leaders across sectors and communities who agree that expanding Help Me Grow is a smart and effective investment. In the fall of 2015 through early 2016, the Commissioner of Education convened a working group to look at the education, access, and developmental needs of homeless children 0 to 4. 16 individuals, including myself, from Greater Minnesota and the Metro, representing homeless shelters, early education providers, education, school administrators, public health, elected officials, including Representative Moran from this committee, provided input and expertise on components of the report, and provided recommendations that would meet the developmental needs of homeless children ages 0 to 4 to ensure academic success. One of the recommendations that came out of this working group was that we should adopting extended Help Me Grow model would provide personalized assistance for families to help navigate available systems, services, and resources. This should include establishing a comprehensive online directory of supports and services, including a parental portal. While available to all families, this portal, which Help Me Grow, would be beneficial to homeless families and with children ages 0 to 4. So with that, in conclusion, I'd like to ask you to support Governor Dayton's recommended appropriation of $3 million per biennium to support and expand the state's Help Me Grow system. Thank you for allowing me to testify, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you very much. Welcome, and I'm not sure if I have your name right, Ms. Barty Wahi.
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 Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Barty Wahi, and I'm the Executive Director of the Children's Defense Fund in Minnesota. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today, specifically on the governor's investment in his budget regarding Help Me Grow. Help Me Grow, the expansion of the Help Me Grow information referral system provides an opportunity for the state to promote healthy development for every child prenatal to 8. It establishes a statewide comprehensive system of early identification, referral, and follow-up for children. My colleagues today, including Ms. Nutella, spoke, I think, quite eloquently to how early detection for kids and a system of referral that allows the many people who touch children and work with them every day to help a family move into that system. We know, based on Children's Defense Fund's Kids Count data book, that approximately 630,000 children 0 to 8 and 68,000 pregnant women could potentially benefit from this expansion. So the reach would be far, not just here in the metro area, but across the state of Minnesota. We have a particular point of view on Help Me Grow because for 20 years now, Children's Defense Fund has worked to increase access and enrollment to work support programs and tax credits for lower-income Minnesota families through our Bridge to Benefits program. Bridge to Benefits is an online system of connecting families to public programs in a way that is user-friendly, to be honest with you, given the complexity of the eligibility and the application requirements. That tool has allowed us to understand that families, particularly low-income families, and those who have multiple barriers to success, need support in understanding eligibility requirements in terms of, and in gaining referrals to programs that they need. Barriers such as language, literacy issues, transportation, lack of awareness, complex application process, multiple program applications, verification document needs, prevent families from enrolling in programs that their children could use and could help them early. We believe Expanded Help Me Grow would provide a localized and personalized access point that would reduce these barriers to enrollment for families and ensure access to services that would improve child outcomes for families and of color, for American Indian families, and low-income families across the state. We encourage this committee to support the governor's investment in Help Me Grow because it represents an opportunity to catch our young ones early and connect them to services that help them thrive. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wahi. Any questions for either of these two witnesses? Representative Dabney.
Thank you very much. And sorry I didn't capture your name, the gentleman from PSP.
Daniel Gumnett.
Sir, I actually used to work for a partner agency of yours and was in your facility several times a month and saw a lot of cute little kids running around and a bunch of good-looking middle-sized kids running around as well. And I'm wondering if you can talk about how many different schools do kids who live at your facility end up attending during the day? Of the school-age population.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Governor.
Mr. Denny. On an average day, 30 to 40 buses pull up in front of people serving people to take children to schools throughout the metro area. So it's quite a large number. While many of them are concentrated in Minneapolis Public School System and Hennepin County, it really is a very broad range. The McKinney-Vento legislation mandates that children be bused back to the district they were attending prior to becoming homeless, so children go to quite a few numbers of schools.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you for that. And just one quick follow-up. What, and you may have mentioned this, and I apologize if you did, what percentage of your guests are school age or younger? Maybe that's the way I'll ask it.
Well, Madam Chair, the average age of a child is 6 in our shelter. 39 to 40% are under the age of 6, so that gives you an idea that most of them are school age. The average age of a person in my shelter is 16 years old, just to give you an indication as to how young the population is. The average age of the parent is around 19 years old.
Representative.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Daniel, I know I care to be also around Part C in trying to make homeless children a priority. Mm-hmm. So how closely do the shelters work with MDE so that they can identify homeless children?
Mr. Gumnett.
Madam Chair, we work extremely closely, particularly with the Minneapolis Public School System. They are in on a regular basis doing screenings. There's also a Healthcare for the Homeless clinic on our site, which does additional screenings. Our staff makes probably at least 4 referrals a month to the Minneapolis Public Schools for special ed screenings. We also work closely with many other outside agencies like St. David's to do more complex screenings for students that might have more complex sensory and other psychological issues. Madam Chair.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as we talk about Help Me Grow, it seems like all the referrals are connected to special education, mm-hmm. right? But I think I also heard that not all children will get an IEP. Mm-hmm. So what happens in that instance? Because we know the first 3 years of life is so crucial. So what happens when they don't rise to a level of an IEP, but they may still have some developmental challenges?
Mm-hmm. Well,
through the Help Me Grow program. Yeah.
Madam Chair, I can't speak to what happens in the school districts. I know that at our facility we create individualized programs for them because our work is primarily with children before they get into school, but I'm not sure what happens at the school district level.
Madam Chair, can we call someone back up who was speaking on behalf of Hetley Grove?
Who did you want to... Oh.
It was with Mayor.
Oh, from the governor's office?
Yeah.
Mr. Carter or Ms. Munson, if you want to come forward.
All right, thank you very much.
Welcome. Please just identify yourself for the record.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Melvin Carter, Executive Director of the Minnesota Children's Cabinet. And the question was about children who do not qualify for IEPs.
Representative Murray.
Yes.
Right. So that's part of the goal of expanding the Help Me Grow system. Right now, our Help Me Grow system is funded through Part C, Early Childhood Special Education funding. And so the referrals that we make, as was testified to earlier, are accessible for children who qualify for early childhood special education services, and they're not able to be, obviously, if they don't qualify for those, they cannot be served in that way. The expansion, the goal of the expansion is to make that portal available for all families and children to be able to access a wider array of services, community-based, school district-based, state-administered resources through that portal. We had just under 16,000 referrals into that through that system in 2016. So making sure that we're able to connect all of those families to resources is a priority instead of just the ones who qualify for those services.
In Madam Chair. So currently, under the current capacity of Help Me Grow, we have a large amount of children who have not been served. and that development and delay is gone, is continues to go undetected.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that is correct. We actually don't have an exact number of how many of those 15,767, I believe, is the exact number of referrals in 2016 did qualify for that early childhood special education services because our current system actually, we don't have the capacity to track that data. The expanded system will give us the capacity to track that data and also provide short-term care triage and short-term care coordination services to make sure that we're not just pointing families in a direction, but having the capacity to truly connect families to resources.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming on. All right. We have a few other people who said if there's time, they'd like to testify. So, and I'll let you choose if you want to come forward or not. But Josh Downham with Minneapolis Public Schools, Leslie Moore, Education Partnership Coalition, Sarah Clark, Coalition for Children with Disabilities.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Josh Downham, Minneapolis Public Schools. And much of my testimony has been covered by many of my colleagues, but it was great that Mr. Dumnit actually went right before me because he does oversee the largest family shelter in the state in Minnesota, and many of the students who attend Minneapolis schools actually go through that program. And one of the changes that I know is in this bill related to a voluntary pre-K is to allow us to partner with people serving people to have them be one of the eligible community partnership sites. So I appreciate that change in the governor's bill. And quite frankly, just the expansion of VPK. We were able to use it to double the number of all-day pre-K slots in our many of our high-poverty sites, as well as make available more half-day slots. And we did supplement and provide additional slots for those dollars. And we're really looking forward because, as Ms. Gilbert said, the greatest demand is for our all-day program. And I was visiting with a group of aspiring principals. I spoke to them yesterday after the committee hearing, and I just asked them, what investments would get the most bang for the buck? If what should I be over at the Capitol lobbying for? And the number one thing they said was full-day pre-K, because the first day of kindergarten, they can tell those students that have been in the full-day program. They know they're there, they're ready. I really look forward to getting more resources for that. But the second piece was helping resources to help stabilize families. And, Madam Chair, I appreciated your comments yesterday about getting more mental health services in our schools. And what I would ask the committee to consider is also preventative, so we don't actually have to have the mental health services. And one of the pieces in the governor's budget is it's actually not in your committee, Madam Chair, but it's in the governor's budget. It's something called Homework Starts at Home, and it's an $8 million recommendation that will help stabilize families experiencing homelessness and provide rental subsidies for families. And quite frankly, the housing instability is the most troubling piece for our families. Just from the beginning of the start of the school year until winter break, we had 1,530 new kiddos show up at our schools. We also had 900 students leave, and the vast majority, two-thirds, left the city, many leaving the state. So the mobility is, and it's so hard to create those relationships, and I think Representative Erickson, when we discuss tomorrow some of the issues around school safety and violence and talk about compensatory next week, Madam Chair, it all gets back to the ability of the adults in the system to make relationships with those students so that learning can take place. And I know Superintendent Ed Graff is going to be speaking to the policy committee tomorrow specifically about that. So. Look forward to those discussions and happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Dunham. Appreciate it. Questions? All right. Leslie Moore and is it Ms. Nguyen? Sarah Clark? We have like 3 minutes officially left in committee time, so I'm going to ask people to come up quickly and be very brief.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am, for the record, my name is Emily Nguyen. I'm a program manager with the St. Paul Promise Neighborhood. I am here just to be a support for Leslie, who is a parent. I'm here today on behalf of the Educational Partnerships Coalition. We are a collective of 6 collective impact organizations across the state of Minnesota. The members include St. Paul Promise Neighborhood, Every Hand Joint in Bedwin, the Northside Achievement Zone in Minneapolis, Northfield Promise in Northfield, Austin Aspires in Austin, Minnesota, and Partnership for Student Success in St. Cloud. We come together around one very clear goal, which is to close the education opportunity gap that exists by bringing together rural and urban communities to learn from each other, to develop best practices, and to also be able to replicate a model that's successful. We've seen a lot of tremendous outcomes in these communities to lift 2 generations of Minnesotans out of poverty, to help them thrive and to join our state's workforce. And to speak more truth to power, I would like to pass the mic on to Ms. Leslie Moore, a parent leader in Central Promise Neighborhood.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Leslie Moore. I'm a parent in the St. Paul Promise Neighborhood. I want to thank Governor Dayton for including support for the Education Partnership Coalition and budget. We appreciate his support. I also want to thank the House and City for their support, especially the members on this committee. We look forward to sharing more about this important work in front of your committee when we testify on Representative Haley's bill, House File 734. I never thought in a million years I'd be sitting here in front of an education finance committee. 3 years ago, I thought when I walked past this building, I'd get arrested for walking in it. I didn't think I could just come in and voice my opinion. You know, I just walked in one day and I'm looking around and I'm like, okay, I'm going to go into this office, but where the security at? You know what I'm saying? But anyhow, I am a member of the Village, the Minnesota PCA group, one of the Minnesota PCA groups. I'm kind of like a baby in this. I'm learning more about education and the housing piece. Me and my son, he's 10 years old. He's my partner. And he loves going to school. He's an awesome kid, and I met many awesome kids. I also attended a E3 workshop, the Education Excellence and Equity for Our Children, and it was awesome, you know. And I met a lot of awesome young youth, you know, educated, and I just, you know, they talked a lot about sports, but I was asking them about their academics and things like that, and they didn't mind sharing it, you know. They smart kids, you know. But my son, he has gotten certificates in being a leader. And he come on with all these science projects. I don't know what they be teaching, but them science projects, he just do a lot of those. And I just think this education piece is really important. I mean, it's not just only for my son, but for all of our children. And I know we pressed for time, so.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Ms. Moore. I really appreciate you coming in, and I hope you will continue to come and share your views. And I do imagine we are going to be hearing Representative Haley's bill. I hope you'll come back then, because I'd like to hear more about how the St. Paul Promise Neighborhood has helped you and your son. Sounds like he's doing well in school.
Oh, yeah, Madam Chair and Committee. Yes, I am very grateful for SPPN, because if it wasn't for SPPN, I would have never got a chance to meet Governor Dayton, who I think is awesome. Oh, my God. I walked and saw him at one of the schools, and he was sitting there, and I didn't even know he was the governor. You know what I'm saying? So, and he started talking to me, and I'm like, at first I'm like, what's this man, right? Then when they introduced us, like, that's Governor Dayton. Oh my God, the governor at the school? I'm like, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that he came out at the school and shared with me his story that I should also share my story with him. We was talking. And also with a couple more people in Rena Moran. If it wasn't for Rena Moran and SPPN, I would know nothing about the legislator, anything. You know what I'm saying? I didn't know anything until I met all these awesome people in this program.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to get a chance to talk to the governor tomorrow. I'll tell him he's got a big fan. I appreciate that. All right. Ms. Clark.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I was going to make this 30 seconds, but I will cut it down to 10. I'll just start by saying that while I agree with Leslie, the governor is awesome, I think all of you are also awesome. So thanks for the time today. I'm just here on behalf of the Pacer Center and the Coalition for Children with Disabilities. I want to express their support for the governor's inclusion of special education funding increase in his budget, and we look forward to working with all of you to hopefully increase special education funding as well. With that, I'm done. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Ms. Clark. Very efficiently done. Mm-hmm. All right. Mr. Vandercoy. Did you want to take a minute, or would you like to wait? I'm sure we'll have another committee to talk about purpose. If you want to wait, that's up to you. Or you. All right. Come on down. I'll give you a full minute. It's starting right about now.
I'm Ben Vandercoy, the acting chair of the Perfect Center. Last time I was here was with the presentation by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Three quick things. Shortly after that, we met with them, went through the recommendations, we're making progress. Second, tomorrow we have our annual meeting where we'll be hopefully choosing our interim executive director. More about that in the future. And finally, crosswinds. And that's really your concern as well as ours. We have a task force that will be appointed tomorrow. And we hope to have an answer by our March meeting, decision by Easter. I think there will be changes coming with crosswinds. Hopefully you'll appreciate that because we'll come back to you and tell you about it. That's it.
Thank you. I appreciate that quick update. And like I said, I know we'll be talking about this more later, but I just want to give you the chance since you took the time to be here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I had one other testifier, Nathan Chamalo, Dr. Chamalo. Again, you'll have to be equally as brief, and I apologize, but...
Sure. No, thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I'm Dr. Nathan Chomel. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Academy of Pediatrics. I'm a pediatrician internist who practices in Brooklyn Center and St. Louis Park. And so we're here just to support Help Me Grow and the funding allocation included in the governor's budget for your consideration. Early identification of developmental and learning disabilities is critical to early intervention for the health of the infant and child and for the family that will be supporting that infant or child. Early childhood interventions have been shown to give a return on investment not seen at any other period in the educational spectrum, making them the ideal target for limited educational funds. There's several key reasons that Minnesota pediatricians support Help Me Grow. Some of them have been mentioned by other colleagues here. Help Me Grow partners with primary care clinics and providers, and that partnership is important because providers are a trusted resource for families. About 79 to 90% of newborns to age 5 will see a primary care provider versus about 50% end up in child care settings. And some pediatricians have shared with us that they see a number of families where there are developmental concerns, but not yet at a diagnosable level. So the child would most likely not qualify for special education at that time, but if other community supports and programs are able to intervene early, then it's less likely that that child will need special education down the road. And finally, primary health care providers do not have the time in clinic to be searching through resources of varying quality and accessibility, which may change frequently. Help Me Grow is able to be the trusted resource, and the partnership between primary health care providers and Help Me Grow utilizes the strengths of each. So the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics strongly supports the Help Me Grow program as an investment in infant and child health in Minnesota. Thanks for your time, and any questions, I welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Chamalo. We appreciate you being here. We are well over committee time, and I'm eating into someone else's time for setup for the next committee, so we must end. We'll do minutes tomorrow, and we'll catch up with that. So with that, committee is adjourned. Thank you.